impact does flying have on the environment? Should people just stop buying cheap airline tickets? What is the fate of the industry? In this episode of Tipping Points, we will hear from an ex-pilot and a campaigner, both pushing for a transition to dramatically reduce the number of planes in the sky. With me, an ex-pilot and the co-founder of Stay Grounded, a network who campaigns for reducing aviation. Todd Smith flew as a senior officer for Thomas Cook until it collapsed in 2019 and has since changed tact to be a frontline activist, calling out the environmental impact of the aviation industry. And Magdalena Hoyvita studied international development in Vienna and lived for 2 years in Latin America, where she experienced the negative impacts of green offset projects, such as hydroelectric dams and forest conservation. The offsetting from aviation led to co-authoring several books and reports such as Carbon Colonialism and The Illusion of Green Flying. So welcome to you both. So starting with you, Todd, could you explain why you became interested in flying initially and how you feel about your career as a pilot now, looking back?
Yeah, thanks, Pete. And thanks for having us on your podcast. It was actually growing up in a working class family in Essex, Greater London. You know, my dad was a builder. He always said to me to do a job you'd enjoy. And he used to say if I was naughty that, you know, I'd end up like his dad on a building site. So it was instilled in me from a young age to try and do something that would bring me joy. I guess a few years into early childhood, I was at Southend Air Show. Was watching the Red Arrows aerobatic display team. And I just remember, you know, my whole family, my aunties and uncles and cousins, everyone was paying so much attention, you know, as a young, insecure child, I suppose you could say, you know, I kind of attached to that idea of, well, if I'm doing that job, we'll get all the love and, you know, sort of attention that I needed. And yeah, quite early on, sort of set my heart on wanting to do that as a career. And in hindsight now, I can see a lot of influences from Hollywood, because I always wanted to be a fighter pilot. And people would say to me, oh, well, what happens if you die, you know, you get shot down? And I'd say, oh, well, if I died doing something that I loved and fighting for Queen and country, then can't be such a bad thing, you know. And you kind of grow up with this idea of World War II and a common enemy and the military being a good thing and a patriotic thing. And that dream never left me. And well, I was in the Air Cadets and I was recommended for a flying scholarship at 14 years old, having performed a perfect loop with an aerobatic instructor. You know, I was good at flying and academically I struggled a little bit, but yeah, eventually got the lucky break into the airline world. And I spent 5 years training off the back of the 2008 recession, huge financial commitment, took a loan out. You know, I needed help from family. My mum and dad remortgaged their house. My grandma helped me out. 130,000 is what you pay to become a professional airline pilot nowadays. And there's no help from the government at all. You're not even eligible for a student loan. In their eyes, it might as well just be a driving license. I became a flying instructor for a couple of years. You know, everyone that I knew was finishing training and nobody could get a job. It didn't matter if you studied at Oxford or all of the prestigious flight schools. The industry just didn't recover as quickly as we expected after the 2008 recession. So I sent out hundreds of CVs and I just went straight into flight instruction and did that for a couple of years because I loved the job. You know, I love flying. There was no money in it, but I was building hours and experience and was able to give something back to aviation in a way. And eventually I got the break onto the Airbus A320, 180-seater. And every airline requires that you have 500 hours minimum, but no one's willing to give you that first job. So to get past that milestone really opens up the horizons. Having spent a year with them, I was based in Iceland for the majority of the time, flying out, you know, seeing the Northern Lights and just having the most profound experiences. And then got the job with Thomas Cook. Yeah, it wasn't long. It was a couple of years into that job, but I had my medical revoked. I actually stopped flying before they went into liquidation. Losing the medical was the first time I had an opportunity to stop and think and assess. Hypocritically, I was using my staff travel benefits to go see the world, but I also saw the effects of mass tourism and climate change firsthand. There was a mountain in Peru called Rainbow Mountain, which is just 100 meters lower than Everest Base Camp. Recently, it's been so-called discovered because the snow's melted. And there I was up there on this mountaintop looking at this beautiful, you know, rainbow-colored mountain and just couldn't help but feel how bittersweet it was, really. And, you know, going into the Amazon jungle and feeling that connection to nature in a way that I'd never experienced, you know, at the same time Extinction Rebellion was happening in London, all these kind of conflicts were arising. You know, I never even really considered the environmental impact of aviation. And yeah, that just grew and grew, festered inside me. And, you know, it's now what I understand to be eco-anxiety, the sense of betrayal from our leaders and the industry. Yeah, it meant that I eventually came to the decision that I couldn't return. You know, as much as I want to be a pilot, I still would love to be in the sector. I just can't morally come to terms with it. My conscience, you know, won't allow it, knowing, you know, what's at stake and how much aviation has an impact. So I guess from then on, it's just kind of, you know, doing all I can to ensure the industry is sustainable. Looking back, you know, I could never have imagined I'd become an environmental activist. I wasn't sure I'd even make it as a pilot, but you know, I guess the illusion of having all the things you thought you ever needed in life to be happy and then getting there, the capitalist dream in a way, you know, materially I had the things I thought I needed and it didn't fulfill me in any way, but activism and, you know, serving with meaning and purpose certainly does.
I mean, it sounds like a success story when you go through that, but then it's in the back of your mind, you're thinking, actually, hang on, no, this is not a success story. This is a tragedy unfolding here. Mm. So, Lena, I wonder if you could give us a bit more about your background. And was there a particular moment that you might describe as your tipping point when you changed direction to focus more on activism?
It was quite interesting to listen to you, Todd. I knew parts of your story, but not everything. For example, you having a working class background, you know, the friends with working class background I have didn't fly with their family as a child, maybe just recently started their first trip on the plane or started getting used to it. Yeah, and I'm actually the opposite. I'm like this green voter, middle class child that flew with my parents to take holidays, and you know, there's this contradiction and, you know, voting for the Green Party, but flying a lot. And I think for me, it's quite hard to say that there was this one tipping point, actually. I don't know, traveling through Latin America as this rich white kid also. I mean, this is like this privilege that so little people have, and still I wouldn't like to miss it at the same time, because it did open my eyes to a lot of inequality issues and neocolonial aspects. I never chose aviation as my main topic. It was rather that it came to me because, as you said, Pete, I did work together with some indigenous organizations for some time in Honduras and then also in Mexico. And I saw that their main problem are often green projects, like land grabbing through supposedly ecological or climate projects, like offsetting. Then I realized, okay, the biggest demand for offsets will come from the aviation industry with their new climate deal, which is just a greenwashing deal.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned travel is sort of a key part of learning about the world's problems, because It's something which comes to the privileged population around the world and the highest consumers. But in a sense, travel opens the eyes to the problems around that overconsumption.
It can. So it can open the eyes, but I think in the majority of cases, it doesn't. People just fly, you know, to mass tourism resorts and just want to get their package of, you know, at best, the food they're used to, the alcohol they're used to, and the parties they're used to, but not really getting to know other cultures and really staying for longer and trying to understand their own privileges and maybe get rid of them. You know, it's so such a difference.
Yeah, speaking about the privileges, I wonder, Todd, if you could tell me any shock stories from your time as a pilot.
When I got medically grounded, I was considering going into a flight instruction route on the Airbus, which is essentially in a flight simulator. One of the companies they were subcontracting for was a VVIP airline. Abramovich had an Airbus A340 under this company. Yeah, and these are not private jets. These are commercial passenger aircraft stripped out with luxury and even worse than you can possibly imagine. And they had a whole fleet of Airbus A320s, which I used to fly as well, would normally seat, you know, up to 220 passengers. I recall this story, which really troubled me. As I was in this transition, this company had flown a state leader out of a African country. And yeah, he'd regularly go over to Florence in Italy to have his tailor-made suit done, you know, and they'd give cash tips of $1,000 or whatever to the flight crew. And yeah, it's just so hard to be aware of that other side of the spectrum when I'd spent so long at that stage already understanding by 2050, according to the Institute of Economics and Peace, there's up to like 1.2 billion climate refugees. And for the most part of the African continent, large parts of it will be uninhabitable. And it was just worlds apart. Yeah, so that was hard. That was one of the reasons why I felt even too conflicted in the end to carry out a simulated ground-based role, and even thinking of training people to go into the sector. Is that not in some ways worse, you know? So, and just being able to be enthusiastic about aviation in the way in which I used to would have been quite forced.
Must have been very, very difficult to deal with, because presumably you felt that all of these luxury and amazing things that you'd worked so hard for were all just shutting off. And what was left? A huge debt.
Yeah.
So how did you cope with that?
One day at a time, really connecting to the bigger picture as much as possible, reminding myself what's at stake was key. And the people, the community that I met through XR, Magdalena, she was one of the first people that I met. She was running an aviation campaign called Save People, Not Planes. And we got connected in that way. And although I lost a lot of community, and, you know, in many ways I was ridiculed and bullied, you know, two and a half years ago, climate denial was still a mainstream narrative. And in the aviation sector, Greta Thunberg was a pinup for, you know, abuse. And it was really hard. And I think we talk about the societal collapse and stuff, but I think in reality, what we will see is like small collapses in different ways in different areas around the globe, and personal individual collapses. And, you know, for my whole identity, which I'd formed around that job title, to be deconstructed in that way unexpectedly is something which still is challenging. But as much as you can, I've made peace with that fact that there's much more to life than a job title. And, you know, yes, I'm in a lot of debt still, but 120,000, not, yeah, with personal debt. So still, we just got to do what's right. And I think aligning yourself to your morals, you know, my journey into veganism and stuff helped.
Changing your diet is a really big deal in itself. And I think this is what a lot of people who are waking up to the climate and ecological crises, that actually it's not one thing you need to change. It's lots of things, lots of major things.
And I think one of the biggest or maybe most important changes could also be sparing time for activism or sparing time for caring for others in the global south and taking time to really change structures. And I guess that's also what we're trying to do with the Stay Grounded Network. It's not so much telling people to stop flying. When I get told by someone, stop doing that, then maybe there will be like resistance reaction and I will continue doing it or doing it more because people want to take their own decisions. So it really also doesn't help telling people to fly less. And it's also not our main focus because we definitely need to change the structures. It's so crazy that flights are so cheap in comparison to climate-friendly alternatives, if they actually exist, you know. And for example, to Canada, there's no ship. These are really things that should be progressed and fostered and financed. And we have to put pressure on governments and institutions to really change that. Also, European train travel, that's there's so much to do, especially booking systems, for example. And now I will actually go for a slow travel trip, 10 weeks to travel. I really experienced how hard it is to book trains across several borders. If you don't speak different languages or if you don't know where to look, and there could be so many things to be changed, not only the prices. And I think that's the main thing that needs to change. We don't aim for a reduction to zero because I think there are still legitimate flights, but there are a lot of bullshit flights too, which are flights that are unfair. For example, space trips. Now, freight flights, for example, for fast fashion supply or even animals being transported by plane flowers, private jet flights, and business class tickets, which take up a lot of space and therefore, you know, are a lot more climate harming. So these are the things that should be reduced, and there should be incentives to reduce them. And that's much more important than putting the main focus on new technology. Green flying will not be possible in the next 2 or 3 decades. And the main issue we have is that by 2030, we will have to have reduced our emissions by half, the emissions from the whole world. And now the problem is that the global north is most responsible for aviation emissions. By far, we have most of the frequent flyers. That's where we need to massively reduce. And there is no technical option to do that in the next 10 years. It's not like planes will fly with zero energy. There's always a side cost of it. So if we fly with renewable energy, like kerosene made from renewable energy, and the question is, where will this be produced? Will it be again produced in the global south? So many plantations only for our fuels, leading to environmental destruction, to human rights violations, to forests being burned, and actually and causing more climate harming emissions. So a lot of those supposedly green solutions are actually quite harmful and neo-colonial.
There were some projects that you were fighting against, which looked like a great idea, you know, hydroelectric dam and reforesting areas, but you fought against them. And I wonder if you can expand on that.
In Honduras, this hydroelectric dam was planning to sell offset credits to the global emissions market, for example, to an airline, which could then claim to fly carbon neutral. The problem is, apart from this authoritarian and repressive way of implementing those projects, it's not like if an airline buys credits from such a hydroelectric dam, that this is reducing emissions. Not at all. So that's also one of the major problems of offsets. And about 2% of the offset projects actually lead to reduced emissions. Most of them claim that they do, but in reality, the reality is quite different.
Todd, I wonder, when you first learned about these things, were you in the, you know, in the pilot staff room talking to each other about this? And did other people agree with you that this was crazy? Or did you feel like the only one?
Well, firstly, I guess it's worth saying, when I came to my first local XR meeting, I thought we could still save the world by all buying a Tesla and going on a few less holidays. So I was a complete product of what capitalism wanted me to believe and is still pushing for most. You have some conditioned trust in your leaders and in the government, and I didn't question things as much as I didn't think critically. I guess that's a skill I've learned over time. When an airline would say there was an offset or something, then, you know, as a conscious consumer, I would go for it. Or I guess in the early days when I had my medical revoke, I would justify my travel using my staff travel benefits by saying, well, I'm just paying the tax on this ticket. I'm not creating the demand. You know, the flight's going to go anyway. And when I go to Thailand, I'm going to do scuba diving and do some marine conservation course. So I can kind of offset it in a way which I felt would be meaningful in my own way. But I guess really I just had to accept that that was a hypocritical position. And I had to sort of looking at Greta and, you know, really walk the walk if you're going to talk the talk. And there was a WhatsApp group when I was a flying instructor I actually created. I started to share Guardian articles and stuff as I was seeing this stuff filter through. It provokes a psychological defense in most responses because, I mean, pilots especially are so attached to that identity to psychologically accept that the very thing that they're doing as a career and have spent their whole lives trying to achieve is a big part of the problem is too difficult, too uncomfortable.
To come in a second, but I'd like to say at this point that I'll be recording interviews on the topics the police, the media, and education from the start of February. So if you have any questions about the role of these topics in addressing the climate and ecological crisis, or to give feedback on the podcast, please email tippingpoints, all one word, at imperial.ac.uk. You can find the privacy policy at the Imperial College Grantham Institute website. Now, on with the podcast. I've got a few questions on the media and certain industries who are perpetuating this kind of greedy lifestyle. And the Guardian newspaper is one of the most prolific to report on the climate crisis. But I did some analysis on the travel section on the issue with Greta Thunberg on the cover. And over 30% of the trips involved either flights or cruises. Have the Guardian been a focus of any of your campaigns?
Not yet, but you know, I'm certainly very aware of any media organisation that still accepts money from the fossil fuel industry is one that you can't really trust. I saw it really clearly with Sky News Daily Climate Show and their sponsors for the weather are Qatar Airways. And to anyone, the untrained eye, they wouldn't notice it. But to me, it was quite obvious. There was a really subtle pro-aviation narrative.
Yeah, and there's a BBC show called Take Off, a new show with Bradley Walsh and Holly Willoughby. The idea is that they help members of the public win a flight to a different exotic destination every week. The set is made out to look like an aeroplane. It's got a live audience, whoops and cheers. How do you both feel about that? And is that just a sign that the BBC are ignoring climate change?
Yeah, no, it's just, yeah, completely absurd, but it doesn't surprise me anymore. The BBC also produced some children's material not so long ago about the pros and cons of climate change, and it was just terrifying. You know, I had to take it back in then because the pros were like, well, it might be a bit warmer in your country, so you could grow different fruits and vegetables, you know, and you could completely absurd. But it's funny you mentioned that show, actually, because I've applied to be in the audience. I don't think I've had my ticket come through yet. But if I happen to end up in the audience, then I'm sure we could have some fun. But yeah.
If you had the opportunity to speak with Bradley Walsh after the show, what would you say to him?
You know, the approach I'm taking now is to just be a human and be vulnerable and, like, you know, ask him what he thinks about the climate crisis. First and foremost, establish, does he care or does he understand? And if he shows any level of understanding, just call it out. You know, how on earth can you sleep at night if you're promoting this in this way? You know, when we're in this Earth 6 mass extinction event, it's an existential threat. You've got children, have you not? Like, the time for being political and dancing around the problem is long gone. You know, over 80% of the world's people have never even stepped foot on an aircraft. And that statistic out of all of them is the one that troubled me most, because, you know, that really sums up how much of a pinnacle of injustice aviation is. And of course, the people of those 80% that have never flown, they're disproportionately affected.
Lena, do you want to come in there?
Only 1% of the world's population. That causes 50% of commercial aviation emissions, while more than 80% of the world's population have never set foot on an airplane. If you take one return flight, Paris, New York, that's more than the average footprint of an Indian person per year, or three times the average footprint of an Ugandan person per year. Yeah, you just fly once and it's massive.
I can see that being a powerful argument for people going on holiday or business trips when maybe they don't need to. But what about if people are flying to visit family or doing something that would be classed as perhaps more essential? So is the right tact here to try to get families back together again geographically so that they don't have to fly around the world to see each other? Or are we making an exception for families to fly around the world to see each other?
It's a lot more reasonable to fly once every 4 years to see your close relatives than to just take, you know, simple holidays for a week or 2 weeks, or do business trips, which you could do online, or send around useless stuff. I think that's a really, really key question. I'm also asking myself that. I actually also thought about living in Barcelona. I mean, that's still reachable from Germany with the train, but I thought, okay, I can decide for myself to take the train, but I cannot tell my family or friends to not fly, because I mean, they will take this decision. So in the end, I said, okay, no, that's not a lifestyle that works with my environmental consciousness. At the same time, I mean, I was able to take this decision, you know, and I think lots of people don't have such an easy time taking that decision because they are migrating, because they are actually fleeing, or they don't see any, you know, perspective in their country. Or, and then those refugees usually don't take a plane. They don't have the money and the visa in order to do that. So there is also a huge injustice around this.
Something we often hear is, you know, but I've got family, you know, in another country. And it's a really compelling argument, of course. You know, when we look at the best types of carbon extraction technology right now, the, if you could call it that, the direct carbon capture technology, you know, that's running in Iceland, running off geothermal power. When I was donating to that project, it was costing me about $1,000 per year to extract one ton of CO2. And I mean, it's a ridiculous amount of money for one ton of CO2. If the real cost of the damage that aviation causes to the planet was reflected in the ticket through like a, you know, tax on aviation fuel, for instance, then you probably would think twice about moving to Australia. You know, on one hand, it has been a beautiful thing that in the world that I grew up in, it's been more connected and, you know, we've had these luxuries. But for some people, they have the experience of seeing other cultures and stuff. But yeah, it's, yeah, I agree with Lena. I think on the most part, that's not how it is. And the main thing with that argument around family is it's just not the issue, really. Long haul flights are a huge problem. They're the worst type of flight you can obviously take. The reality is, you know, when 1% of the population globally creates 50% of the emissions, it's such a small percentage of people frequently flying, you know, taking the weekend break in Spain, going on the stag do, you know, the people that are flying 3 or 4 times a year. And I think the other thing that really troubled me was the United Nations say that we need to be below 2 tons of CO2 per annum by 2030 to be sustainable. And like
that's, you know, per person, right? 2 tons per person.
Yeah. And when I went from London to Bangkok and back in economy as a passenger, that flight alone was 3.5 tons. So, yeah, it's a systemic issue. But, you know, if you're flying and you're still consuming meat, as far as I understand, they're the two most detrimental things other than kind of changing your pension.
You said that the big costs in terms of carbon emissions are around what we eat and how we travel. But then there's a statement that having a child is the most carbon intensive thing you can do. But presumably that is dependent entirely on your lifestyle. As you were saying, Lena, you know, someone born in one of the Central African countries, of course, having a child isn't going to be the same as the carbon emissions as someone born in the UK, presumably. And even within the UK, there is going to be a vast spectrum. So I wonder what your thoughts are about bringing up a child.
It's funny because I'm pregnant right now, and it took me a long time to take a decision if I want to get a child or not, but not because of the emissions produced by that. Rather because I just fear that in the next 10, 20, 30 years, the world just will look totally different, and it'd be a really hard time for this child, even though it grows up in the global north and in regions that are not as badly hit than others. And also because I thought, okay, will I have enough time to still do the amount of climate activism I'm doing now? And I do want to have this time, and a child needs time. But we cannot monetize or evaluate in numbers life. So in general, I think it's a hard thing to do, to say, okay, a child is this amount of numbers and emissions, and that's why I decide in favor or against it. It really depends on the lifestyle of this person.
Feel free not to answer this, but I just want to know what your vision is of a future where in 10 years' time, let's say, things might have gone quite badly, in a sense that's what was playing on your mind when you were deciding to have a child or not.
So, I mean, I can very well imagine that in 10 years, it will be a lot harder to do agriculture. For example, we might have a lot of issues with water scarcity. I mean, there will be a lot more difficulties. So we might actually face problems of hunger. And even here, biodiversity, the whole ecosystem will get confused by changing temperatures all the time and changing weather events. A lot more floods will happen, a lot more thunderstorms and strong weather events that, yeah, destroy houses and cities. And I do, what I really fear is also that with rising migration, that right-wing parties and movements will rise a lot more. And I'm living in Eastern Europe, where already the right-wing party has a lot of traction. And so I'm living in a surrounding, in a countryside where I'm getting more scared, actually. People get more aggressive and that society gets more divided. And yeah.
I imagine that listeners to this may have similar visions, and and not knowing whether to bring a child into that or not. I think that's something which is quite common, especially among our age category. So, Todd, I wonder what your thoughts are about having a family.
Yeah, thanks for answering that, Lina. That's it takes a lot of courage to, you know, to speak about this. It's something I had to navigate very carefully in my last relationship. My partner wanted to have children, and, you know, I shared sort of Lena's view as well on, you know, what you read a lot of scientific papers, you sort of work out probabilities and statistics, look at what's actually happening, trajectories, and overanalyze, I guess, in a way. And I guess that's stress provoking. And if the act of love for a couple is, you know, to have a child, then that's everyone's right. And I think, you know, my therapist kind of said that maybe you should ask the child, you know, write a letter to the unborn soul and, you know, ask them if they want to come. But yeah, who knows what the landscape will look like. We have to accept that we live in an inherently unstable world. And yeah, it's a very difficult question. I'm not currently in a relationship, so it's not one I have to think about too much, but I think I'll probably try to avoid, again for Lena's reasons as well. It's like, you know, I'm not sure that I could, you know, it's a difficult thing to cope with, you know, knowing what could happen. But also that idea of, you know, where do I want to be? Who do I want to be in the face of all of this? Because we're kind of emerging into two classes of people, those that can move and those that can't, as the two classes. And do I want to be on the front lines in the Maldives when the island nations go underwater? And the problem with the climate ecological crisis is there's just nothing that's gone before it at the scale of psychological complexity to even begin to understand what the right or wrong thing is to do. I get glimmers of optimism sometimes, because when I see humanity at our most vulnerable, or in the midst of a crisis, an earthquake, for example, we always see the best of people come out. Lena's hopefully fortunate in the sense that if she's tired as a mother, that someone else in the community can provide love and nourishment to her child. We don't live in communities anymore. And, you know, mothers are tired and they can't, this is how we evolved as 200,000 years of evolution. The problem is all these traumas and attachment issues that are coming out as a result of our society. Without these issues, you wouldn't have the Trumps and the Johnsons of the world. You know, we live in a deeply traumatized society, and big businesses benefit enormously from our distractions and our addictions and our, you know, consumer capitalism. But, you know, really, so a huge part of this healing process isn't just the activism, but it's the internal work and healing ourselves and bringing the society. And the vision for the future for me is that action on climate change means that we have a better quality of life, where we are reconnecting. We're living in such separated times, but we need to find that unity, which is our biggest enemy in terms of the media trying to divide us all. If we can find that unity and understand that we are one people on one planet and deeply connected to nature, and that our, yeah, that we don't need the things that we've been conditioned to, you know, believe we do. I think that's where the solution lies for me.
Lena, if you can give one takeaway message that you hope to leave with listeners, what might that be?
I think it would be great if people could start chatting a bit more about their personal choices around flight habits and and also pointing out the structural changes needed.
I strongly recommend that you check out staygrounded.org with a hyphen between the stay and grounded for articles from Lena and others, including the free PDF of The Illusion of Green Flying. It's got a lot of information in it. And with that, Todd and Lena, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, too.
Thanks so much, Pete.
Now, thankfully, Todd was able to stay on the call for another few minutes so I could ask him a few more questions. I wonder if you could explain how some flights are so cheap. How can you get a return flight to Rome for 25 quid? How does that work?
Well, this is a funny thing in a way, because the low-cost model, the likes of Ryanair, Wizz Air, EasyJet, etc., they've made quite outlandish claims about how green they are, because firstly, they fly the newest aircraft, and then they also have the highest load factors, which means there's not often many empty seats. So per flight and per passenger, because you're utilizing all the space and capacity in the cabin, you know, they can be quite efficient. But the way in which they save money is just by Ryanair's model, for instance, they'll spend half an hour on the ground and try and turn the aircraft around, offload, reload the passengers, refuel in half an hour, and get the aircraft back in the air as soon as possible, because it's not making money unless it's in the air. The staff salaries, the terms and conditions would be lower. In Ryanair, you had to pay for your own uniform. Airlines used to pay for your flight training, and that gradually got eroded over the years. They basically exploited our passion for aviation as, you know, enthusiasts, and said, well, if you want it that bad, then you'll find the money. And that made it, of course, inaccessible to people that couldn't afford the hefty fees that came with it. So yeah, essentially it's just cost cutting at every level. They make most of their money, Ryanair especially, through, if not through the sale of the ticket, but the after sales, like the cabin baggage and fining people £50 if they haven't printed off their boarding pass or term and condition that isn't that well publicized, and, you know, overweight baggage and stuff. So that's really where they make their money, food and catering and alcohol on board.
Duty on aviation fuel is a bit of a murky business, and that leads to planes flying with more fuel than they will need because of the cost of fuel in different places. Could you clear this up?
There's no tax on kerosene anywhere in the world, which is essentially another subsidy, which allows, you know, the likes of the low-cost model to make more money. It's just one that's not that overt. Something called fuel tankering, where if the fuel is cheaper in one country compared to another, you would take more than was required for the flight, and you get a minimum amount of fuel plan. Airlines would look at this from their end and try and save money by bringing an extra few tons of fuel back to the UK, for instance, even though just by merely having that extra weight on board, you could burn an extra ton of fuel. But to them, it, you know, the CO2, and it doesn't matter. It's just all the economics driving it. So there's many instances of, you know, trying to save money and burning much more fuel in the process. But as long as they're saving money, that's obviously the driving factor for the business model. But it's a huge problem. There isn't any tax on kerosene itself, aviation fuel. You have airport duty. You know, it's hard, but they say it's hard because you need international agreement. But you know, it's kind of chicken and egg. Someone's just got to start and lead the way and make sure that the International Civil Aviation Authority organization, they do take it on board. Because I think that's actually, there are different mechanisms, like a frequent flyer tax levy to ensure that it's the people that fly most that pay most. But just by having a tax on kerosene, you are definitely going to impact the high emitters first and foremost, because they're more likely to fly long haul and to fly frequently. And for a person that, you know, saves up their hard-earned cash for a short haul flight every year or so, the short haul flight doesn't burn as much, so they're basically basically wouldn't be paying much more than the normal price for their ticket.
You mentioned Jet Zero, which is the government strategy for net zero aviation. But what are the issues around that?
Well, it's, you know, with most of the language that comes from politicians, it's well thought out saying that zero emissions flight is possible. And even through their own admission, less than 5% of their proposals in the Jet Zero plan would be zero emissions in terms of electric aircraft. But if you look deeper into electric aircraft, of course, the electric's not currently coming from renewable sources on our grid. So that's not even zero emissions. It's zero tailpipe emissions, which is what they are referring to. You know, there's this really dangerous narrative that has come from the likes of Shell Aviation and Big Oil called, and they've conveniently called, sustainable aviation fuel. No, these alternative fuels, many of which are not sustainable in the slightest, biofuels, for instance, or, you know, blue hydrogen that requires huge amounts of energy at the moment, you know, it's still coming from dirty sources. And yeah, so, you know, each of the individual alternative fuels which are proposed, they're not scalable, and they don't consider the upstream emissions or the non-CO2 emissions. The government are just trying desperately to do all they can to come up with some sort of fairy tale that the public can get on board with to make them feel okay about getting on the business as usual or business as almost as usual. So, you know, I was actually had an opportunity at the Royal Aeronautical Society's conference recently, and the CEO of the Jet Zero Council was there. She was saying lots of greenwash, and that she was also the climate, you know, lead at Heathrow Airport. But she said, don't worry, you know, she's got different hats and there's no conflict of interest there. So, of course, when Heathrow pushing for the third runway, you think, yeah, okay. And she, for her own admission, says she doesn't know much about climate change, but she's been hired to do that job because she gets the job done and doesn't get involved in the emotional debates. And I just, you know, she said during the Australian lockdown, they had a 3-week gap, and what they saw was flight loads were up 100%, which indicated the demand. People want to get back flying again. So I was fortunate enough to get up and ask a question and say, well, yeah, I had an awakening during the lockdown also. And it was how nice it was that you couldn't see the contrails in the sky and hear planes overhead London, and you saw nature come back, and that I could never return to the job that I'd spent my entire life dreaming of doing. And I could see she felt some shame and guilt in having to hear that after this performance she'd just put on. She had children as well, and she said that she took it seriously because of that. And, you know,
but yet she didn't know much about climate change.
Yeah, exactly.
What's your interaction like now with the unions?
BALPA Pilot Union, the biggest in the UK, formed an environmental study group, and I of course volunteered as a member. I was expelled after 2 or 3 months from the group because the National Executive Council had heard about me and that I had links to XR, and they didn't like the fact I was talking about growth. They just wanted to stick their fingers in their ears and say that, you know, we're not going to reduce the workforce, you know, and ultimately that means less membership for them. And they just wanted to play the narrative of, oh, well, there's going to be plenty of so-called pilot jobs on vertical takeoff and landing eVTOL, which are electric 4-5-seater personal luxury hovercraft, essentially. And they can't get the regulations to have them autonomous. So they will need, you know, a so-called pilot in there pushing buttons for the first decade or so, until they can become fully autonomous. And they're just ways in which you connect big hubs like Heathrow, and most energy inefficient way of flying by taking off vertically.
Would you say that you're well respected among the piloting community who have heard you speak and saying things which they never hear?
I think respect has to be earned. And for a lot of pilots who have probably had somewhat of an awakening, when they now go to the family party and cousin or the friend of the auntie says, oh, what are you doing? He says, I'm a pilot. And they say, oh, how do you reconcile that? They're struggling a little with they want to feel proud of their jobs again. I have had really great conversations, often behind closed doors with aviation workers, not forward facing, because they're too scared to say what's really on their mind publicly right now. And, you know, there's gagging clauses in airline contracts, so they can't speak to the media. The landscape has shifted so much in the last couple of years. I hope all the hostility that I have received so far, the knee-jerk responses from aviation workers, former colleagues and stuff, when they do generally see that it's in workers' interests and we're actually trying to improve their terms and conditions as well and make life better for them and for their families. And if they really understood the nature of the emergency that we're confronted with, then they might just come around.
What's one takeaway message that you'd hope to leave with anyone listening?
In the same way that the pandemic forced us to stop and slow down and really consider what's important in life, give yourself some space and question, you know, what you value. I kind of often think about my young nephew, knowing what I know, what will I say to him in 10 or 15 years' time? You know, put yourself in those shoes and go through that thought experiment, because who we are in the face of all this is really important. And don't believe the lie that we're not powerful. You know, as individuals, we are powerful. And when we come together collectively, we can win. I do generally believe that. It's going to be a chaotic struggle, but it's entirely possible. So, yeah.
Thank you, Tom.
Pleasure. Thank you, Pete.
Music from Climate by Eric Ian Walker, commissioned by the Climate Music Project. We communicate the sense of urgency of the climate and ecological crises through the emotional power of music. More to be found at ericianwalker.bandcamp.com and climatemusic.org.